Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. I've always been fascinated by the concepts of deep space and deep time. Distance is so vast, they are measured in the years it takes light to cross them, and time so deep that they're measured in billions of orbits of the Earth around the Sun. And mountains are my favorite place to go experience both of those concepts in one of nature's grandest settings. So it was with great delight that I saw one of my favorite geology authors, John Dvorak, had a new epic book out called How the Mountains Formed, A New Geological History of North America. And it didn't disappoint. It's a sprawling tale told through the lens of the mysterious origins of life on Earth and its evolution through vast amounts of time. Gothic tales of upheaval and drama in which mountain ranges rise and oceans advance and retreat. And Dvorak also makes clear that the geosciences are in the midst of a remarkable period of their own evolution as the theory of plate tectonics undergoes refinement through the probing of Earth's complex interior by the study of seismic waves. Dvorak joined us recently from his home in the Big Island of Hawaii to talk about this new view of Earth. John Dvorak, welcome to Blue Dot.
Well, hello, Dave. It's good to be here.
Well, I'd like to start out by, this is a big book, you know, it's epic in scale. You know, you're talking about the entire history of the Earth and even a little earlier, the solar system, and you cover so many places on the planet, especially North America. What inspired you to write this?
Well, many things have. One of the early ones was just flying over the continent and looking down and wondering how this this continent actually formed. And then having a little bit of a background, being fascinated by the landscape, trying to sort out sort of the Grand Tetons, Yellowstone, Adirondacks, the Mississippi River, how these various pieces actually fit together in a coherent story.
Yeah, and it's a big story. So I'd like to kind of start at the beginning, as it were, because you take us through in the book, basically from the beginning of geologic time to the present, and using the geologic time scale and what we know about it now. What I found really interesting was in the very beginning, you talk about like the earliest life forms on Earth and how Earth formed. How did you go about, you know, researching that early stuff? The interesting thing to me was, and maybe you could comment on it here, the role that like Jupiter and Saturn played in, you know, how things, you know, set up for Earth very early on.
Well, our whole idea of the origin of the solar system has changed radically in the last 20 years. 20 years or more ago, it was a very simple thing. It was this slowly rotating cloud of dust and gas around an early star that condensed into the sun. And then this dust and gas formed rings, and the rings became planets. And it was all very orderly and happened over a long period. But today, we know that's not the case. We know that certainly early in the history of the solar system, the orbits were very chaotic. Jupiter certainly forms first, and it forms rapidly. And that's simply because once you start forming a large planet, its gravity overpowers everything else, and it grows at a terrific rate. So really, the whole origin and evolution of the solar system is buried in the story of Jupiter.
And the thing I found interesting is that the orbits of Jupiter and Saturn haven't always been where they are.
Well, that's right. About 20 years ago, there was this whole big revolution in understanding how the solar system formed. And what we're understanding is that Jupiter and then later Saturn form in the outer reaches of the solar system through gravitational interaction by throwing dust and gas out. They actually spiral down. And then there's this miraculous that's still not very well understood. There's a reverse in their motions. And so this is known as the grand tack, sort of like tacking on a sailboat. These planets came down close to the sun and then working together through through gravity, they started to migrate out. So when we look at where Mercury, Earth, Mars, Neptune, Jupiter are, that's not where they were early in the solar system. And that's probably not where they're going to be another couple billion years from now.
And what role did they have on the formation and development of the Earth very early on? What kinds of things did they do that affected the outcome of what the Earth would be?
Well, that's still pretty murky. Exactly how you go from the dust and gas to form an Earth is still very much debated. But what people probably think has happened is that right now we think of the four inner planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars. There were probably many planets like that in the inner solar system. And as Jupiter came closer to the sun, it threw a lot of them into the sun. It probably threw a lot of them out of the solar system. And so what we're seeing are just a few of the relics left from this very dramatic phase known as the Grand Tack, early in solar system formation.
Yeah, I found that fascinating. Okay, let's talk about early Earth. What is the earliest evidence we have for a solid crust? Like, you talk a lot about these amazing crystals called zircons. Could you tell us a bit about them?
That's right. If you're willing to say a piece of the Earth, which you have to essentially look at with a magnifying glass, there are these crystals known as zircons, because they have a lot of zirconium in them. And what they have is that once they form out of a magma, they're extremely durable. They'll withstand high temperature, high pressure, the most severe acids, and they just endure for a long time. And so they are actually our oldest physical pieces of the Earth. The oldest one is about 4.4 billion years. They've been found in Western Australia. And they're very exciting. Unfortunately, I think only probably less than 100 have yet been identified. And among the things that they tell us is that even back at 4.4 billion years ago, there was probably a substantial amount of water on the planet. There may have been an ocean. There had probably been quite a bit of processing of rock from the mantle, and there was some type of early crust. We also find out about that at least by 4.2, 4.4 billion years ago, we used to have this picture that the early Earth was just this hot, hellish place. Well, it was certainly hot. It was like an extremely warm sauna, but it wasn't just this constant outpouring of volcanic masses. There was at least small masses of dry land, but most of the planet was probably covered by an ocean.
Yeah. So let's talk about the earliest rocks. When do we have the first record of actual rocks on Earth? Because if we look at like the geologic time scale that many people might be familiar with, you have the Cenozoic, which is the current era, and the Mesozoic, the time of, middle life, which the dinosaurs and all that, and the Paleozoic, the time of ancient life. And then it always says, Precambrian before that. But that's just, it's a gigantic chunk of geologic time is, the Precambrian, or what used to be called that. When are the earliest rocks we know of on Earth, and where would we find the earliest rocks in North America?
Well, the earliest rock, meaning being able to actually hold something in your hand, is the Acasta Gneiss. It's up in the Northwest Territories of Canada, and it's 4.030 billion years old. It's very hard to reach. The oldest one, if you want to go to a place where it's rather easy to find, it's substantially younger, about 3.6 billion years, you'll find it near Morton, Minnesota. That's the Morton Gneiss, and that is the oldest rock in the United States. Now, there's a lot of time here, 3.6 to 4.0, there's 400 million years. That's almost the length of time ever since animals have been on the planet. But if you go to, say, Morton, Minnesota, There's just a small outcrop. It's just to the west of town, a little knoll. There's only about a half dozen to a dozen places on the entire planet where you'll find older rocks. And so this really is a fascinating place to be.
And when we talk about the geologic time scale that, you know, many of us are familiar with and seen in textbooks, at least, could you just discuss how that was developed and the role that life on Earth played in developing that scale? Because it's really the fossils and the change in fossil life that gives us those divisions, doesn't it?
Well, that's right. If we go way back in the history of geology, the way that rocks were divided essentially into three parts. There was the very old stuff, which people thought was the granite. And then there was all of this stuff in sediments. And then there was the very young part. And people essentially just divided the Earth history into those three stages. The problem with that is that as people look closer and closer, you can find granites invading into sedimentary rocks. So there are these granites that must be much younger. So as people started looking closely, and as they started going around the world trying to correlate rocks, it was found that the best way to correlate a rock unit in one area with another is if they had identical fossils. And that would eventually give rise to what is the geologic timescale today. As the evolution of life occurs, that is, different forms of life go on the planet, we're able to construct this timescale, this ladder.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our exploration of Earth through time with John Dvorak, author of the new book, How the Mountains Formed, A New Geological History of North America. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back. Let's continue now on our visit with planetary scientist and author John Dvorak as we talk about his new book, How the Mountains Formed, A New Geological History of North America.
I've been traveling around North America for about 50 years, looking at whatever I could. Grand Canyon, Mississippi River, the Grand Tetons, and so forth. But what is really exciting is how dramatically our perception of the Earth has changed in just the last 20 years. And that's because of two big things have happened. Number one, the mass spectrometers are much better. So we get better age dating of rocks, and we can separate isotopes better, which means we get a better idea of ancient climates. And the other thing is with seismic tomography. There was this multi-hundred million dollar project called EarthScope, funded by the National Science Foundation. And its purpose was to use seismic tomography to look at the inside of the Earth. Seismic tomography is similar to what a CAT scan is to the human body. A CAT scan uses X-rays. They shoot inside the human body at different angles to sort of to come up with a detailed picture of the inside of the body. The seismic tomography uses earthquakes that originate in different parts of the planet. They pass through, and we're looking at the inside of the Earth. The Earth is no longer just a concentric spheres. It has a whole lot of individual features in it. Some of them are the size of continents. And we're just starting to look at that. And so this combination has really started another revolution in understanding the Earth.
Yeah, and that tags on to the revolution in Earth science that was the development of plate tectonics theory, basically in the 1960s and 70s. And one of the things I found really interesting in your book is that our understanding of what's causing the plates to move, the plate motions themselves, that, you know, that the Earth's crustal plates do move horizontally and not just up and down, as the earlier geologists thought. And then one of the most interesting things to me in your book is the story of the Rocky Mountains, because I never understood in terms of plate tectonics how that really worked. I could understand how the San Andreas Fault formed, or how the Cascade volcanoes formed from the melting subducted plate and the blobs of magma coming up and things like that. But the Rocky Mountains always seemed kind of mysterious to me. And could you tell us a bit about the story of the Farallon plate?
Yes. And I'll have to say the story of the Farallon plate, the history of the Farallon plate, and the origin of the Rocky Mountains is still being written out. So there's still a great deal to understand about it. The Farallon plate, back when we had a supercontinent about 300 million years ago, known as Pangaea, that is North America, South America, Asia, Europe, Africa, all the continents were essentially together. That starts to split apart. And as it splits apart, the Atlantic Ocean forms. Well, we look at North America, and it's moving to the west. And out to the west is a large ocean. And there's a tectonic plate, an oceanic plate underlies it, which we call today the Farallon plate. And North America overrides the Farallon plate, and it did so for about 140, 160 million years. And it looks very much like it does in South America. But what is intriguing that we understand now, until about 20 years ago, we could only trace the Farallon plate down to maybe about 400 miles. But now through seismic tomography, we can follow it all the way under North America. It lies, you stand almost any place in the United States except the very western part of California. And if you could drill a hole down about 400 miles, you would hit the Farallon plate. So it underlies pretty much all of North America. Then it takes this big dive down into the Atlantic. All of this is brand new. And what this has done is that when you look at the Appalachians, that you look at the Rockies, you look at the Black Hills, you think about earthquakes in Missouri, South Carolina, or even up in New England, that is probably all due to the history of the Farallon plate. Now, I have to underline, this story is still being written, but that's the direction that people are thinking. You have to change your perception of understanding the Earth. We've always thought about the surface and trying to figure out the inside. You've got to think more about the inside of the Earth and how that affects what we're seeing on out here on the surface.
Yeah, and when you say dives down into the Atlantic, what you're talking about is it dives below the Atlantic Ocean basin, deep down into the mantle, right?
That's right. In fact, it might dive as far down as the core mantle boundary.
Wow. Yeah, that's I found that fascinating. And one of the things that I found most interesting is this tomography, these images. It's like you said, when I used to teach earth science as a science teacher, you know, we had this basic model of you had the inner core, which was a solid iron nickel, and then you had the outer core, which was liquid, and then you have the very thickest layer, the mantle, and then on top of that is the very thin crust. And the plate tectonics model that we had was that convection in the mantle would be like, you know, if you turn on a burner in a pot of soup, you get the convection currents where the heat rises and you can see your noodles and stuff come to the surface and spread out to the sides and then sink back down in these, you know, circular convection currents. And the thought was that's what the plates are riding along on top of these convection currents. And one of the things I found interesting in your book is that is maybe a little too simplistic, that actually gravity is playing a much more important role. Could you talk about that a bit with how the plates subduct, like the Farallon plate?
Well, that's right. When plate tectonics was first proposed in the 60s and 70s, there was a natural question, why are these things moving around? And what seemed to be a straightforward answer is that it was hot inside. The interior of the Earth is convecting, very much like a boiling bowl of oatmeal, and that this was rafting the plates around. Well, today it's thought that only about 5 to 10% of the motion of the plates is because of internal convection, the releasing the heat from deep in the Earth. Most of it is coming from these thick, cold, rigid oceanic plates, like the Farallon plate, diving down into the Earth. These are dense, and they get pulled down by gravity.
Yeah.
And so the way that I picture it, it's not just a hot bowl of oatmeal convecting on a stove. These big slabs are like giant spoons that are churning up the mantle. Now, if you had some other experts here, they would say foul. They would say, but you don't know that much. And I'll agree. I don't know a great deal because people are still trying to figure out exactly what is the position of these slabs. How are they moving? It seems that some of them are creating very small convections, currents beneath places like the Sierra Nevadas and other places like across the Atlantic. They're stirring up huge amounts of the mantle. And so this is still a very hotly debated and a lot of questions being answered as to exactly what's going on deep in the Earth. But where you're finally seeing what's going on in the deep part of the Earth, so much that you mentioned the inner core. The inner core of the Earth is iron nickel. It's surrounded by this fluid iron nickel outer core, but people are actually seeing features inside the inner core, these gigantic, what people have said are these gigantic crystals. And so we're even looking into the inner core and we're seeing individual features.
Yeah, it's our technology is in, you know, developed so rapidly that we're just getting more and more data. And with that, you know, that's how these models evolve. And who knows where they'll be, you know, 20 years from now. But what I do find interesting and compelling about it is it's a lot more complicated than that simplistic model that, you know, I saw in textbooks just a few years ago.
Well, yes, that's right. And even when plate tectonics was first proposed, people knew there was a problem here because it has two major components. It has the movement of the rigid plates, which would presume to be moving by convection. And then it has these hot plumes like Hawaii and Yellowstone rising up. And it wasn't clear how those two things might be related, but it's a single system. So there's gotta be a way of relating these two.
Yeah. Like I said, I found some of this stuff very interesting to me because it was new and new to me. And that's one of the things I love about your book is because it does give you a state of the flux that Earth science is in right now.
Well, yeah, if I could point out, early on in plate tectonics, people understood there was a problem. The Black Hills of South Dakota is one of the youngest mountain ranges in North America. But it's nowhere near a plate boundary. It sits right in the middle of the continent. Rocky Mountains is really the backbone of the continent. It also is hundreds of miles away. And then if you go, this has become one of my favorite places in Western Kansas. You go out to a place called Monument Rocks and you get these limestones, this chalk, which if you look at them, there's fossils from the ocean. How was this land once way under the ocean and then it popped back up? We didn't have a very good idea, but now that we're looking at the history of the Farallon plate, we're understanding that there are features on the Farallon plate. It has pulled Western Kansas, is really the whole central part of North America down, and then it sprang back up. It was sliding up high, creating the Black Hills and the Rocky Mountains. It part of the North America plate seems to be peeling off, and that is the origin of the Grand Tetons and the Sierra Nevadas, and even the Appalachians. It seems like part of the North American plate is starting to separate off, and we have some sizable hills in the western part of North America, very far from a plate boundary.
Yeah, when you mention that chalk rock at Monument Rock there, that's the same kind of chalk you find at the White Cliffs of Dover, right?
That's right. It's the same time period.
Yeah, that's interesting. So there was an inland sea that kind of divided North America back during the time of the dinosaurs. That's the current understanding?
Oh, yes. I mean, the evidence has been out there for over 100 years. People have understood it. There just wasn't a good explanation for why the center of the continent was flooded, but not the western and eastern end. And now we get into all kinds of questions of like the dinosaurs. I admit, before I wrote this book, I sort of thought a T-Rex was sort of running around the planet. But now I find out that T-Rex had a very restricted range to Western North America. And that's because it was this large inland sea. There is no T-Rex that ever stepped in New York or the Carolinas. They were in Western North America from Northern Mexico into Southern Canada.
Yeah, and that's why we find those fossilized remains in places like Montana and, you know, the Rocky Mountain area.
That's right. Those spectacular finds of dinosaurs.
Yeah. Well, since we've mentioned the dinosaurs, let's talk a bit about them, because another part of your book I really enjoyed reading about was we've always been fascinated by dinosaurs and trying to understand, you know, how they came to their demise. And I think most people now know that there was a large asteroid that hit the Earth at the end of the Cretaceous. But again, the story's a little more complicated than that. The Alvarezes discover this clay layer in Gubbio, Italy, which is, you know, full of iridium, and this whole idea that a massive impact, you know, ended the age of the dinosaurs. Could you tell us where in North America you can go? Because there's a spot you have pictures of in your book where you can actually see this layer of change between the time of the dinosaurs and not.
Well, that's right. When I started writing the book, I asked the question, how come I've never seen this layer? If this big impact hit in Mexico and threw all this material up in the sky and it rained down, how come I've never seen it? And it's been found at about 140 places on the Earth, but most are really hard to get to. But there is a favored place. There is a very accessible place. It's in Southern Colorado at Trinidad State Park. There's a big sign that tells you in the parking lot that you're at the right place. You walk only about a quarter mile, and you can find this light clay gray layer. It's about half an inch thick, and that's it. And you can put your finger on it. And if you have a hands lens, you can actually see some of the little spheres that when this stuff was thrown up and it came back into the atmosphere, it heated, and this stuff was molten and fell out of the sky. But that's the place to go, Trinidad State Park in Southern Colorado.
Wow. Yeah, it's amazing how you can look at that little tiny layer, and if you understand what it's telling you, you know, the significance of what happened back then. Okay, let's talk about another really interesting part of your book, much further back in time, and something I never really totally understood until I read your book. And that's in the Grand Canyon, which has all these wonderful layers of geologic time preserved. It's like going through the history of the Earth. But there's this thing called the Great Unconformity. Could you tell us what it is and what it means?
Oh, yes. The Great Unconformity. If you stand at the edge of the Grand Canyon, you're actually looking at two canyons. There's the upper wide canyon, and that's the one that has all these horizontal layers of great color. And then there's a very steep, narrow canyon where the rocks are mostly dark. And between the two is something known as the great inconformity. There's this great disruption of time right there. If you go down the Bright Angel Trail of the Grand Canyon and you reach it and you put your hand on it, there's about, as I recall, about 1.7 billion years of time missing. That is about one third of the Earth's history. Either wasn't laid down, or more likely, it's all been scraped away. And the question is, what is this thing? You can find it all the way across North America. Again, if it's difficult to actually reach in the Grand Canyon, but there's a very excellent place just a few miles east of Las Vegas known as Frenchman Mountain. And again, they have a sign up and you walk maybe an eighth of a mile and you can see the great inconformity. But the question is, why is there such a huge loss of time here? And it seems that what this is, there was two periods in Earth history. This was the second one, when the entire planet was encased in ice. It's known as the Snowball Earth. And for that reason, there were very long period of time when ice was just grinding down across the entire continent. And that is probably what the great unconformity is. You find it, as I mentioned, Grand Canyon. You can find it in Frenchman Mountain. You can find it, as I recall, in the northern edge of Lake Champlain, Chippewa Falls in Wisconsin, Arbuckle Mountains in Oklahoma. And there's probably about a dozen other very notable places. But to me, I look at this and I say, again, it wasn't known until about 10 years ago that this represents this really abrupt change in Earth history, when the planet from pole to pole was entirely covered by ice and the ice was grounding down the continental rocks.
Yeah. And how big of a time gap is this?
Well, it depends where you go. If you're in the eastern part of the Grand Canyon, it's probably about 800 million years. And then if you get down to Frenchman Mountain, it's probably 1.7 billion years. And it's because the ice was there, this mile thick amount of ice all across the planet, and it just ground down everything for millions and millions of years.
So there's just no record in the rock of that time.
Well, there's a record, but it is much harder to find. For example, if you go up to Labrador and Newfoundland, there's a record there, but that's because that's ocean crust that's been pushed up against the continent. So there are places to find it.
Let's take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our discussion of Earth history with author John Dvorak. You're listening to Blue Dot. If you're just joining us, our guest is John Dvorak, and we're talking about the latest ideas in geology about Earth through time. He's the author of the new book, How the Mountains Formed, A New Geological History of North America. Okay, one of the really cool things about the book is it's about how mountains form. So we don't have time to go into all the detail. If you want to get that, read the book. But give us some examples of how some of these mountains grew, some of these iconic places that we know.
Well, plate tectonics told us that the outer part of the Earth consisted of these rigid plates that were moving. And so these plates are always colliding and sliding and pushing against each other. And so the usual answer that's given is that where two of these plates are colliding, they push up the earth and they form mountains. That at best is only a partial answer, because as we mentioned, it doesn't explain the origin of the Black Hills or the Rockies. With seismic tomography, and we're looking inside the earth, we understand that there's a process which we didn't even know was going on called delamination. Delamination is when the bottom part of a tectonic plate, like the North American plate, is peeling off. It's a rigid, dense part that's dropping under gravity into a hot, viscous mantle. It's like throwing the ballast off of a ship. And because it peels off, the surface rises. And that's probably what is responsible for most of the mountain mass. There's a problem when you look at the Appalachian Mountains. The plate tectonic answer was, this was a collision that formed Pangaea. This is when the northwestern part of Africa collided with what is now Eastern North America, and it formed a big range of mountains. And then it moved away in the Atlantic. The problem with that explanation is that the collision was about 300 million years ago. And in 300 million years, the eastern part of North America should just be as flat as can be. But it does have mountains. And now we're understanding that there's probably this process, delamination, occurring all along the range of the Appalachians. And that is what has given it to rise. That's probably why the Adirondacks are starting to rise. The Adirondacks, they're very old. The rocks themselves are very old. The mountains are very young. They are just about as young and move almost vertically as fast as the Sierra Nevadas.
Wow. And one of the things that I also really enjoyed about the book is you trace back where all of our fossil fuels come from through Earth history, the coal and the oil deposits and the gas deposits, and how that's tied to, what we're doing now, of course, with using fossil fuels for our civilization, which is problematic, as we can discuss in a moment. But when you do all of that research, what were some of the most interesting things to you about, where all of these fossil fuel deposits are around the Earth?
Well, the first thing to understand is that it doesn't form at a constant rate. There's been specific times in Earth history. The other thing to realize is that North America happens to have a tremendous amount of fossil fuels. It's not just because of exploring for them. It's that during these episodes, when the climate conditions were right and the biosphere was right for forming these fossil fuels, North America was pretty much by itself, sitting close to the equator, whereas South America, Africa, Asia, and at least Eastern Europe were sitting on the south, around the South Pole. That's why North America has really a huge abundance of coal and oil in it.
Yeah, and of course, we are extracting that stuff out of the earth and using it to burn, to fuel our civilization. And you talk a lot about climate change through the history of the Earth, tracing the levels of carbon dioxide. Could you talk a bit about how climate change has driven the story of life on Earth and the geology?
Oh, yes. Climate change has had a tremendous amount, and it's almost entirely tied in with how much carbon dioxide is in the atmosphere. We can go back to 2.5 billion years ago, And there's a huge change in climate in that there's a big drawdown of the CO2 and the first appearance of oxygen. And it's one of the early snowball Earths. As we get to closer time, such as the last, say, 500-600 million years when the animals are here, there is this close tie with what is happening with climate is influencing the evolution of life. And what is happening climate is influencing, through the evolution of life, these deposits of coal and oil.
And you also mentioned these thermal maximums. There was one like, 55 million years ago? Could you talk about what those are?
Oh, yes. The Earth has gone through remarkable changes, especially in the climate. We sort of tend to think of the Earth today that it's probably been like this. But this has been an unusual time. About 56 million years ago, we had what is known as a hypothermal event. This is when a lot of CO2 was put into the atmosphere. The planet got very, very warm. This event, it's got a long name. It's known as the Paleocene-Eocene Thermal Maximum, or the PETM. If you want to see it, go to southwestern Wyoming and go to Fossil Butte. This laid down a formation known as the Green River Formation, which has a tremendous amount of hydrocarbons in it. What is interesting about this is that, except for the present time, this is the previous time when there was a large injection of CO2 into the atmosphere. And that had dramatic effects. It did not create a mass extinction, but it had a dramatic effect on changing the environment and the direction of the history of life on the planet.
Yeah, and you talk about the geologic timescale, and this is something I was kind of vaguely aware of, but I was wondering if you could tell us a bit more about it. You mentioned that Portland, Oregon could be thought of as Volcano City. Why is that?
Oh, yes. I grew up in the Portland area. I often puzzled about these features. And what you find out is that there's all kinds of recent volcanic vents all around the Portland, Vancouver area. Rocky Butte, Mount Scott, Battleground Lake, Beacon Rock. About 2 million years ago, it's come in two surges. About 2 million years ago, there was a surge that I think lasted a few 100,000 years. And then there was a more recent one. And it formed a whole series of volcanic cones and cinder cones and such. The most recent, if you know of the Columbia River Gorge, Beacon Rock is about 54,000 years old. It is the core of a large cinder cone. But then you got to scratch your head. I don't see all this stuff. And that's because of those great Missoula floods at the end of the most recent ice age. That is, there was a large lake in western Montana. There was an ice dam holding it back. It broke. The water poured down across eastern Washington, forming the scab lands. It entered the Columbia River Gorge, following the Columbia River, and it poured through the Portland-Vancouver area, and it essentially carried most of the cinders and other things away. So what we're looking in Portland, it may not impress you, but there's a lot of recent volcanic activity. Yeah, right,
and
there.
We tend to think of this like Mount Hood and Mount St. Helens, which is not far away from Portland, but that's not the whole story.
Well, that's right. In fact, there's an overlap in time between the volcanics in this Portland-Vancouver area and the Cascade volcanoes. And people are just starting to sort of unravel what is one and what is the other, exactly what the story is here. But the important thing is to recognize that, yes, Portland, Oregon ranks up there like Naples, Italy, and Auckland, New Zealand as a volcano city.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's talk about now. And I've heard this term used many times recently, that we may be in a new period of time called the Anthropocene. Could you tell us how that term came to be part of our parlance? And what are some of the signatures that geologists of the future will look for to see this is the beginning of the Anthropocene, the time of humans?
Well, there's a raging debate going on, and I can't emphasize raging, as to are we in a new geologic epoch or not. When we look around, we see that there's dramatic changes have occurred on the Earth. In the last, and it depends how you want to choose, 20 years, 50 years, 200 years, human activity has become a geologic force. For example, human activity is moving more than 10 times the amount of debris and dirt and sediment as all the rivers, all the rivers on the planet. It's human activity that has dramatically changed the amount of CO2. The amount of CO2 before some 200 years ago or even 100 years ago was around 280, 300 parts per million. It's now starting to push 500. So human activity, and that's what the debate is human activity on a sufficient scale to recognize this as a new geologic epoch? Now, this gets us into this whole question of what is known as the Great Acceleration. The Great Acceleration is how human beings, through their activity and the use of resources, have dramatically changed certainly the state of the climate on the planet. But when you think of the warm, most of when we think about climate change, we think of the atmosphere. The big story is the ocean. The oceans have heated up considerably. They've also become much more acidic. It's really the oceans and the change in the ocean currents and their temperature and their acidity that is dramatically changing the planet. For at almost 3 million years, we've had a permanent ice cap in the Arctic. That is decreasing, and that will probably be gone in another 50, certainly in another 100 years. That is a dramatic change in the planet. Plastics, you find plastics just about everywhere. You just scoop up ocean water, whether you're Antarctica or Hawaii or Japan, and it has plastics in it. So that's what this thing is. That's what the Great Acceleration is. It's entirely produced by human activity.
Yeah, and you know, when you take the big picture look at this, the Earth will abide in the long run, and the climate will restabilize. You know, but our civilization may not be able to withstand that in the short term.
Well, that's absolutely right. If you look at the climate change that's going on now, it's not even a blip when you look at all of Earth history. But if you look at the last several thousand years, it's a tremendously large. And the whole key to the lifestyle that you and I enjoy rests on having a stable climate, a stable sea level, because that's what gives us this bounty of food. We really haven't had dramatic extremes in weather until very recently, if you look at most of human history. And so what people are talking about when they're talking about climate change, I want to emphasize, it's not just the atmosphere, it's also the oceans, it's also the ice caps, it's also putting a tremendous amount of things, not just CO2, but also methane and other gases into the atmosphere, that this has very much put the future of world economies on edge.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to leave things quite on that note, but you're in the very final part of your book, you talked about a special night parking on the road at Death Valley, which is really one of those great places you can go, like the Grand Canyon, to feel the depth of geologic time, of deep time. Could you just briefly describe that moment for us?
Yes, this was many, many years ago. I was by myself. It was sometime around midnight. I was driving down that single highway that goes down the center of Death Valley. There was a clear sky and there was a full moon. And so I pulled over to the side of the road and next to one of the salt flats. And I walked away from my car. I walked away far enough so that I couldn't see the car and I couldn't see the road anymore. And I was sort of just bathed in this silver moonlight. And it wasn't just me. It was also the white playa, that white salt bed. It was the mountains on every side. And when I think about it, I ask my question, why didn't I feel alone when I was out there? And it just occurred to me, well, it isn't a feeling of loneliness. It's a feeling of a moment in your life, that this really was one of the grand episodes that I've had of standing out there, just myself, surveying the planet. And it could have been at any point in Earth history. In fact, it could have been a planet anywhere in the galaxy. It was quite a heady experience.
Yeah, and that's a place where a lot of science fiction films have been shot for very good reason. It is kind of an unearthly landscape at times, and starkly beautiful, and definitely a place where, like, you can feel a part of Earth history. Well, John, it was great to talk to you about your book, and so much we didn't even get into, so I recommend to our listeners, this is a great book if you want to learn about the history of the Earth and the history of geology. It's kind of all intertwined. It's a really great read, so thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me as your guest.
Thanks again to our guest, John Dvorak. His new book, How the Mountains Formed, A New Geological History of North America, is available from most major booksellers, and you can check out John's website at johndvorak.net. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Cap Radio in Northern California. We're distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. You can check out this and past episodes at mynspr.org and subscribe to our podcast using the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.